Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The annual New Year gathering in his aunt's house at Usher's Island hasn't really been going too well for Gabriel Conroy, the main protagonist of James Joyce's short story, The Dead. The evening has largely been a series of gaffes and upsets. He's managed to offend Lily, the caretaker's daughter, with a throwaway remark about her love life. He realises, too late, he has miscalculated the tone of his after-dinner speech. A mistake from first to last. An utter failure, he thinks. Someone accuses him of being a West Brit because he has no interest in the Irish language. Worse still, he has been unmasked as a regular contributor to, of all things, the Daily Express. Then, just as he's preparing to leave at the end of the party, he sees his wife, Greta, pause at the top of the stairs and lean on the banisters to listen attentively to one of the guests singing in a nearby room. Gabriel doesn't realise it yet, but the earlier setbacks of the evening are about to pale into insignificance compared to the revelation that will be prompted by the decision of that guest, Bartle D'Arcy, to sing the heartbreaking ballad, The Lass of Aughrim. Richard Ellman, Joyce's biographer, claims the slightly ungracious and self-important tenor, Bartle D'Arcy, of the story, was based on the well-known singer Barton McGuckin. McGuckin was born in Dublin and studied in Armagh and Milan before joining the Carl Rosa Opera Company. Various accounts of his life relate that he achieved a number of firsts. Derek Walsh notes that he was involved in the first broadcast of an opera in Ireland in 1883. A telephone device connecting the Gaiety Theatre to an adjacent room allowed a large crowd to hear him sing in Il Trovatore. Nuala McAllister Hart, writing in the Dictionary of Irish Biography, says he was the first Irish singer to make a phonograph recording when he recorded Thomas Moore's Avenging and Bright in 1903. Barton McGuckin flits in and out of the newspaper columns of the late 1800s and early 1900s. Given that Joyce describes his fictional counterpart as being reluctant to sing at the aunt's party because of a cold, "Can't you see that I'm as hoarse as a crow?" says Mr. D'Arcy roughly at one point. It's a curious coincidence that one of these newspaper appearances is in an article headed What They Take for Their Voice. It's a report on how well-known singers and actors stave off sore throats that might affect their performance. Madame Trebelli has a penchant for strawberries, we are informed. Madame Malibran, on the other hand, drinks half a bottle of champagne with her dinner, half an hour before going on stage. Our hero, however, cuts a more sober and ascetic figure. Mr. Barton McGuckin carries with him strong smelling salts to ward off incipient colds, the paper informs us tersely. His name also appears in connection with a case in the Dublin courts, Waters versus McGuckin. A widow, Mrs. Waters of Charleville House, Dundrum, took an action against McGuckin to recover a valuable diamond ring from him that had belonged to her husband. McGuckin claimed that her husband had given him the ring as a token of his admiration while on board the Etruria on a voyage to New York in 1887, a gift he had repeatedly refused as he had more valuable rings than he knew what to do with, he maintained. Despite his protests, Mr. Waters had insisted on pressing the ring into his hand before disembarking, and so McGuckin reluctantly accepted it. The case was eventually settled in favour of the widow. McGuckin was forced to return the ring. This ring as a token incident provides yet another curious overlap between fiction and reality. The Lass of Aughrim exists in many forms across Ireland and Scotland. There's even a lighter French version from Brittany, where it's known as Germaine. A husband, returns from the Crusades after 7 years, and his disbelieving wife demands proof of his identity. He produces the broken half of his wedding ring that matches perfectly the other half she has kept safely while he was away. And naturally, because they're French, they live happily ever after. But just as Barton McGuckin found himself in some difficulty because of a ring, so too does the girl in Bartle Darcy's song. Most Irish and Scottish versions are songs of betrayal and rejection. In a version collected in Tyrrell's Pass around 1830, the callous Gregory challenges the poor lass who calls at his house with their child on a miserable night to establish her identity. If you be the lass of Ockram, as I suppose you not to be, come, tell me the last token between you and me. She replies, Gregory, don't you remember one night on the hill when we swapped rings off each other's hands sorely against my will? Mine was of beaten gold, yours was but black tin. As with Gabriel Conroy at the end of The Dead, it's about discovering that the person you loved and may always love is not quite who you thought they were.
If you'll be the lass of Ockram, as I am taking you to be, come tell me the last token.
Last night, when I couldn't sleep, I got up, opened the back doors and walked outside. I raised my face to it as if to a lover and opened my mouth. Soft mist on my tongue, and then an urgent torrent drumming against goose-bumped flesh. I breathed it in. Petrichor. The scent when rain has fallen on dry earth. In Greek mythology, Petri means stone, and Kor, the fluid that flows in the veins of the gods. On our wedding day, the heavens opened. We'd hired a marquee, more a glorified tent really, and decorated with Sean Keating's straw bales. Sunflowers, yellow and orange candles, baskets of melons and oranges, blankets, throws, and saris from India. How good it will be, we thought, for our guests to sit with their drinks on straw bales, glimpsing the sea through hawthorn and fuchsia hedges. The day before, when the sun was splitting the stones, my sister Elaine bought me a pair of pink flowery wellies. I had a dress in antique pink, and it crossed my mind that the wellies would match it perfectly. During the night, fog, mist and rain came in from the sea. We ducked from cottage to tent, the rain running down the backs of our necks. The plumber was still checking the pipes, his camper van parked over by the sycamores. The lime plaster was still drying, and the builder Henry, who specialises in renovating old cottages, churches and castles, was as proud as a new father. The naked lunch trailer arrived, all lit up with fairy lights and ready to serve up cappuccinos, lattes and Americanos. And pinned up around the cottage, the coloured bulbs hopped and swayed in their halos of mist. But beyond that, you couldn't see as far as the thorn trees. Anta was preparing to lead the ritual, and our friend John thought it would be a good idea to stand naked in the rain reciting the Our Father in Irish, but we persuaded him not to. The black and white one-eyed cat was still alive, and she hid in the outhouse for the whole thing. Our new neighbours came, and we had a great big electric torch of a thing, the colour of fire, that blew heat out at us. And every time we met, running from cottage to tent, you said, "Thank God we hired that heater." And I answered, "Yes, thank God, otherwise it would have been a disaster." My mother said that she was wet to her underwear and she needed a few hot whiskies, but she made her speech without slurring a word. The Naked Lunch provided the food, and everyone ate it so fast we were worried that there wouldn't be enough. But there was more than enough. It rained and it rained in our little circus, strumming against the canvas tent, harmonising with the fiddle and then the djembes as we leapt and drummed on the bouncy wooden floor. There was set dancing and African dancing, waltzing and jiving, and a kind of ballet to the cello. Then the band sang a version of Mary's Wedding, and you had to keep hitting the roof of the marquee with a sweeping brush to knock off the deep puddles gathering there, and each time you did it, everybody cheered. Mary was there, and she'd made a chocolate biscuit wedding cake. She and Caroline had brought crates of wine from their shop. Aidan bought us a book of Irish love poetry. Fiona was pregnant, so her husband, Ashcan, took the photographs. Henry sang an old English ballad about the cuckoo, and it rained and rained. I had a ring in the shape of a swan. Shell and Louise were our witnesses, and we made different kinds of vows, and so far we've kept them in each season, even when the storms came bullying in from the sea, because we were older, with no illusions about the child of Prague left out overnight, white frothy frocks and perfect days. We knew rain, how to walk around or jump in puddles, and when one of us slipped, the other held steady. Not roses, not summer. Ours is the scent of rain on dry earth, the fluid that runs in the veins of the gods.
We've come west to see in the new year. This is a decision that has much to do with getting away for a few days, of course, to put Christmas and excess behind us, to breathe in the ocean air, to make for the other coast, the wilder, rockier, stormier coast. There's nothing startling about such a desire. It must be hot-wired into each of us, this need for wide skies and exercise and briny Atlantic winds. And what a way, what a place in which to begin another year in the West with a rejuvenation of the soul. And out here, the sky is, yes, larger and more dramatic. The horizon is wider and the towns and villages more scattered. The pace is gentler. The forests are denser. The waters of the fjords are cold and dark, although the scattered little lakes are not yet frozen over for the winter. Dense forests, fjords, frozen waters. Wait, this is hardly Ireland. No, indeed, this is Sweden. Specifically, the west coast of Sweden, the Bohuslän coast that stretches between Gothenburg and the Norwegian border, with stony archipelagos sprinkled offshore and serpentine fingers of the Atlantic pressing dozens of miles into the heart of the land. Our friends collect us at Gothenburg Airport, and we drive north on the coast road towards Norway. A small, cold, red sun hangs low in the southwest. It'll be dark a little after three, although the sunsets last longer than at home. They nibble into the span of night. The Scandinavian touches I've been anticipating are present in abundance. A large IKEA, a graceful suspension bridge leaping a gorge, empty roads and dense woods, and tidy towns with candles shining in every window. Really, every single window. They are ubiquitous. Santa Lucia, how are you? We arrive at Lysekil, the snug town on the edge of the deep Gullmarsfjord that will be our home for the next few days. The sun rises late the following morning and we explore. The hardness of this coast takes my breath away. Long ranges of exposed red granite shine in every direction, gleam in sharp winter sunshine. Tough land to farm in days gone by, I think, coaxing potatoes out of shallow, wet, peaty soil. I say so aloud, And our Swedish friends tell us tales of 19th century famine, of devastating emigration, the countryside cleared of people who could take no more if they survived at all, and who left for new lives on the other side of the Atlantic. Such tales bring connectedness across the sea, I think, linking Ireland and Sweden, Massachusetts and Manitoba and Minnesota, linking suffering at home with, sometimes, new hope abroad. Later, we eat herring and potatoes baked slowly with cream and anchovies. The following day, the last day of the year, is dark and bitter with a wind sweeping down from the north. We take a ferry from Lysekil across the sea to the little island of Gullholmen. It is highly picturesque, with its harbour, its winding lanes, its thickly clustered, immaculate clapboard houses with deep balconies of carved wood. A church, austere, white-painted, with fine chiselled spire. The village is deserted, entirely empty of its inhabitants. The place when it comes to life in high summer, I'm told, when the owners of these second homes travel over from as far away as Stockholm, over 500 miles distant. Otherwise, they sit empty. Stockholm is a long way away, I say, a long way to travel to a holiday house. And there I was, thinking that the drive from Dublin to Connemara was pushing it a bit. But no, the stormy west fulfills a certain function in Sweden, too. The east coast of the country shelves gently into the tideless, brackish Baltic. The craggy red rocks, the endless scattering of islands, the Atlantic tides of Sweden's west coast, on the other hand, call to the soul. We stand by the little landing stage and look out across the water to the lights beginning to shine on the mainland. And then we look back at these second homes, their windows dark on this dark afternoon and empty of lamps and candles. Our Swedish friends smile wryly and ask, "Remind you of anything?" We dine on blini on this last night of the year and bake salmon. At midnight, we go outside and look down across the red roofs of Lysekil towards the sea. The bells of the Lutheran church on the hill begin to peal joyfully, and fireworks explode above the waters of the fjord. "Gott nytt år," we say, and we clink glasses in the freezing, starlit air. Happy New Year.
Tough City Radio, your home at the end of the road, drawls the local radio station's DJ in a raspy whisper. He croons the long O sounds, releasing the words onto the airwaves as though they should have a sticker attached that reads, "Caution, Fragile." Tough City Radio is a tiny independent station in Tofino, a town on the west coast of Vancouver Island, Canada. It's eclectic in its output. Free from the commercial pressures of nationwide or city-based radio stations, it eschews contemporary chart music and plays whatever it pleases, whenever it wants. Sometimes their DJs cut a song short if they feel it's trundling on too long. Sometimes they'll shift from a southern blues number to an epic psychedelic track. Years ago, I visited Tofino, a small, famed surf town, with the intention of spending a month there, but in the end staying nearly a year. "This place grabs you, right?" is what the people there said. Venturesome Ontarians who have traded the Great Lakes for the Pacific Ocean. Restive Manitobans who have fled the vast plains of the prairies for the beaches and tree-blanketed mountains. Disillusioned Albertans who have swapped oil money trucks for beaten-up campervans. The inhabitants of the place are diverse as a Tough City Radio playlist. When winter settles in, the rain comes, as inevitable as the tides. deluges fall in biblical swathes. Unlike home, though, no talk of bad weather is tolerated unless a particularly destructive storm is arriving. Daily chit-chat relies on other subjects, surfing mainly, ice hockey when the playoffs commence, but seldom the weather. "Will it ever stop raining?" I said to one of my co-workers one November day. We stood inside the door of the surf shop, looking out at the rain as it was slavering from the maw of a massive grey cloud. "We're living in a rainforest. It's bound to rain," he said. He wasn't being sarcastic. He was matter of fact, showing a forbearance towards the downpour that I found unfathomable yet impressive. "Don your rain jacket, slip into your wellies, and just get on with things. That's the Taoiseach way." And so the rain lashed against my sitting room window throughout the winter, and Tough City Radio droned on my small alarm clock radio that, in lieu of TV or Wi-Fi, was my sole entertainment system. After some time, I noticed that I had heard very few Irish acts on the station. I almost grew homesick for Bono's voice. One night early in the new year, my friend Luke, an Albertan who had grown up hunting and fishing, invited me to dig clams with him and his friend Carlos. Carlos belonged to the Tukwat First Nation, an indigenous people whose home reservation lies deep in a secluded inlet of Barclay Sound, an hour from Tofino. The night was cold, but rainless. The tide was low. We were careful to avoid digging on native land, skirting the border and ensuring we dug only in permissible territory. The moon was covered by a pall of impenetrable clouds, so we found our way using torches. After gathering the clams, we plucked oysters from adjacent beds, and Carlos told us that, in the past, warring tribes would use the beds as a kind of torture instrument. A captured warrior would be dragged on his back across the shard-like shells. Afterwards, we brought a portion of clams and oysters to Carlos's auntie, who lived with her husband in a timber frame bungalow on the reservation. She was a petite, curious woman and, before my arrival on her doorstep, had never met an Irish person. She invited us to have a drink with her. Over the hours that followed, we drank several more. I sat in the warm sitting room observing the artwork adorning the walls, eating home-cured candied salmon, drinking cans of Bud, listening to Carlos's many stories. He had travelled a lot. He had recently spent some time gallivanting in Mexico until he grew sick of himself and returned home to settle down, to finally grow up. I nodded along to everything he said. I could relate. Carlos's auntie lamented the loss of a pet dog. A predacious wolf had clenched it and stolen it away to the forest. She was worried now that her other dog would meet the same fate. Carlos told his auntie that he would shoot the wolf, but only if she really wanted him to. For a wolf, he said, was a noble creature. Sometime during the night, I was gifted a wooden mass carved by Carlos's cousin. It's on my bookshelf now, watching over me as I write. Then Carlos's uncle-in-law played the Pogues on YouTube, and the cosy bungalow in Barclay Sound along the 49th parallel suddenly felt like one near the Ox Mountains. It was even further than the end of the road of which the Duff City radio DJ spoke, but finally, I heard some music that reminded me of home. In the morning, as we drove away on a rutty logging road, the gleam of the rising sun dazzled the water of the Sound. A gentle wind riffled the branches of the Douglas firs. Canadian geese filed by in the bay. It didn't rain that day either. But for the days that followed, the weeks, the rain fell as though the sky had been sundered.
You're listening to Tough City Radio, 90.1 FM. Taking you to your happy place. It's what's happening in your ears right now.
The village of Rostreva in County Down, at the edge of the Mourns, on the shore of Carlingford Loch, is connected in different ways with two of the 20th century's finest writers. First of all, it is the only place in the north of Ireland to be mentioned by name in James Joyce's Ulysses as somewhere a character has visited. A Dublin barmaid called Lydia has returned from a holiday in Rostreva, suntanned from lying on the strand. Then there is C.S. Lewis, whose many books include The Chronicles of Narnia, that fictional world of magic and mythical beasts. Lewis spent holidays in Rostreva and said that the wooded local landscape overlooking Carlingford Lough was his image of Narnia. These days, however, it's the ideas of many other writers from the local area and beyond which can catch your eye as you walk the streets. Near the entrance to the Fairy Glen, you'll see a board with these words. Instead of complaining that the rose bush is full of thorns, be happy that the thorn bush has roses. Walk past that, and you'll find another board offering further advice. Life is not about waiting for the storm to stop. It is about learning to dance in the rain. In 2016, members of Poetic Action Rostreva set about persuading their neighbours to allow bits of poetry and other words of wisdom to be installed outside homes and business premises across the village. The plan was meant to last for a few weeks, but it became clear that local residents wanted it to stay, and so it has. There are now more than 30 messages inscribed in black Celtic-style lettering on a white background. Many of the authors are local, including a schoolgirl whose words echo what had enchanted C.S. Lewis from a viewpoint above the village. There's no feeling like it, well, none that I've known, than looking down at Rostreva from beside Clochmore Stone. An older resident reflects on time passing. But for me, the saddest day of all that made my heart feel sore was the day I watched the carpenter rip off our wee half door. Poetry Action Rostreva has welcomed new thoughts as long as they are not politically or religiously divisive. That's clear from these messages. Let your heart have no fear. There are no strangers here, just friends that you never knew. And again, for arms of love, not arms of war, it's for these hands we're singing. The singers and writers are not all natives of Rostreva. There are comforting words from Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney. If we winter this one out, we can summer anywhere. And elsewhere, there's advice from the same man on how to do so. Walk on air, against your better judgment. As you walk through the village, you'll come across some international contributors, Chile's Pablo Neruda. They can trample the flowers, but they can't stop the spring. Outside Rostreva's integrated primary school, some relevant words from Nelson Mandela. Education is the most powerful weapon you can use to change the world. Faith, too, can be powerful, says a message further along the same street, written by Rabindranath Tagore. It's on a board facing the woods and green spaces of Kilbroney Park. Faith is the bird that feels the light and sings when the dawn is still dark. Nearby is an invitation to anyone who reads it, at whatever age, to stay young at heart. When you mature, come and visit me. I will be on the swings.
January. Early morning, foggy nightcap on the bay, milky clouds upon the mountain, sun won't show for work today.
I really love the work by the photographer Amelia Steen, and so I wrote this poem about one of her photographs, and it's called Visiting. We arrived to this. Dark shutters weathered by time, folded back, the sudden light a gift to us. An urge to lean over the wrought iron railing, pluck pale leaves from the summer tree to cool our flushed faces. The journey too long, the carriages jolting, our hot foreheads wiped with sleeves, our hands clammy with expectancy. But first, this new room that welcomes, gathers us into the still coolness of its afternoon. We want to claim not just its light, but the shadows brushed finely on the wall, a secret world of shifting grey lines, a reflection of another room we could never enter until now. Drowsy from arrival, we sink into the hush of this waiting space, room within room, its mystery a veil drawn aside, revealing what was always there. A voice unheard, a door left ajar, waiting for us to step inside, arrive.
On this morning's programme, a mix of new and recent archive scripts, we heard Mine Was of Beaten Gold, Yours Was But Black Tin by Conal Hamill. Not Roses, Not Summer was by Lanny O'Hanlon. Red Granite was by Neil Hegarty. Then Rain, Clams and the Pogues on Vancouver Island's West Coast by Matty Brennan. Ross Trevor Messages by Dennis Toohey. And Visiting, a poem by Enda Wiley. The music today was Lass of Ockram, sung by Lisa O'Neill. Mary's Wedding by the Chieftains with Van Morrison. Sancta Lucia, sung by the Swedish Naka Girls Choir. Rainy Night in Soho was by the Pogues, and January Child by Colm Sands. And there are a couple of books by this morning's writers that might be of interest. Conal Hamill and Matty Brennan's essays are included in the latest anthology from this programme, Sunday Miscellany, A Selection, 2023 to 2025, which is published by New Island Books. And two recent poetry collections, Landscape of the Body by Lanny O'Hanlon and Sudden Light by Enda Wiley, are both published by Daedalus Press. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binshee. And you can listen back to this programme on the RTE Radio Player app, on podcast or on the website. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.